It's the takeaway for June 6th. The arrest of the lone armed officer present at the Parkland shooting puts the spotlight on school resource officers.
You've got shots fired in a building. You have to assume you're dealing with an active shooter event. You have to pursue that threat and stop it before more lives are lost.
What should we expect from officers in schools? Also on the show, the specific dangers of being a trans woman seeking asylum at the southern U.S. border.
In this system, you have agents misgendering them. They're telling them, you know, you're a man, and there's a lot of discriminatory language and practices.
And how Ali Wong's new rom-com, Always Be My Maybe, is part of the wave of Asian American comedians carving out their own space in mainstream culture.
A lot of the comedy we see now is actually people just being funny on their own terms. It's not being sort of pigeonholed or restricted or bounded by these earlier kinds of stereotypes.
Let's get right to it. Sheriff Deputy Scott Peterson was the lone armed officer at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School when a former student brought an AR-15-style assault rifle to the school and opened fire. But Deputy Peterson did not go toward the sound of gunshots. Instead, according to witnesses and surveillance footage, he remained outside the building with his gun drawn. He never moved to confront the shooter. On Tuesday, more than 1 year after the shooting, Deputy Peterson was arrested. He's now facing up to 97 years in prison over criminal charges for child neglect due to his, quote, inaction during the shooting. A report released earlier this year said that Peterson was in a position to engage the school shooter and to reduce harm to others, but that he, quote, willfully decided not to do so. The Peterson case has put the national spotlight on the role of school resource officers and whether having a police presence actually makes students and schools safer. But protecting students and staff from mass shootings is only one tiny slice of what school resource officers like Peterson are supposed to do.
On a given day, they may be dealing with building level security. They may be helping a student with an issue that they're having, doing some informal counseling with them, or they may be in a classroom teaching a law-related education block to students.
That's Mo Kennedy. He's the executive director for the National Association of School Resource Officers, and he previously spent about 12 and a half years as an SRO in Hoover, Alabama. And here's Chris Mallett. He's a professor of social work at Cleveland State University who's researched police in schools.
SROs do not make schools safer, but that's not because of what an SRO is doing or not doing. It's because incidents are so infrequent and violence has decreased on campuses for two decades.
Mo Kennedy, the former SRO, starts by explaining the role these officers have on school campuses.
They are deployed in the aspect of community-based policing. So this is really at the core about relationship building. They should be bridging the gap between law enforcement and youth and building positive relationships. There must be proper collaboration between school districts and law enforcement agencies. They have to be partnered in this process, which helps us to kind of lay down the pathway for what this program is going to look like so that we are doing this together in partnership.
Is there a general protocol for school resource officers on how or whether they should intervene in a school shooting?
First of all, I'm going to say that I don't think it is as consistent across the country as it needs to be. We don't train every SRO in this country or every school police officer in this country. I wish that we did. But certainly in our basic course, we get right to the point that no longer, and this is post-Columbine, no longer can we stand and wait for help if we're the SRO. We have got to go and attack the problem. We have got to go and stop this immediately. Every second we wait, there's the potential that young people are losing their lives and teachers as well. So our point on this is we have to be prepared to go direct to threat. And what that means, really the difficult balance here is in finding the right officer to fit in that school environment. This has to be an officer that really has a passion for working with youth, has the ability to get into a classroom and help youth learn about our juvenile justice and criminal justice system, and at the flip of a switch, be the best tactical officer any department has to offer.
Chris, I want to bring you in here to sort of get a sense for how unusual the charges against Peterson are and why that is.
Scott Peterson is a real outlier. My experience and knowledge of those officers who are SROs is that they are not Scott Peterson. His reaction, his inability to handle the situation, but also being charged with 11 counts is not the norm for police officers in general, let alone SROs.
There's been a rise in the number of school resource officers across the country, Chris, and I'm wondering why that is. What's leading to this increased presence of law enforcement in schools?
Well, it's really been a long time coming. There's a couple of things that happened back in the 90s, and Mo mentioned Columbine, which was one factor that led to the 1994 federal law that required expulsion of a student for weapon possession. And it also included, for the first time, federal funding for school resource officers. And a couple of factors that happened in the 90s, one in the juvenile justice system and the one that impacted the schools. The approach to juvenile justice and the more heavy-handed approach to locking up young people was quite detrimental and quite impactful on a lot of disadvantaged students. But that also happened in the schools with the zero tolerance policy that coincided with the increased security measures across all schools. And that also has led to a lot of unintended consequences, not just SRO-related, but student exclusion-related, also impacting students with disabilities and racial and ethnic disparities in punishment.
I want to get into the sort of disparities that you're mentioning there in a little bit, Chris, because I think these are really important in terms of the broader conversation. Going back to just a second to Officer Peterson here, I'm wondering, Mo, you know, there's a lot of criticism and obviously now even more than criticism about how Peterson handled the shooting. With your expertise, what should Peterson have done?
You know, Chris used a good phrase a minute ago, outlier, and Florida is kind of an outlier as far as our association goes because it's a state where we do not train school-based police officers. They do their own training in Florida. So part of the answer to that is I don't know how he was trained. That's part of the problem for me in trying to answer any of this. I've seen the footage. I've talked with several folks who have been involved in the investigation. Clearly, there's an issue here when you've got someone standing at a door for the length of time he did. That's not the way we would train anyone. Again, I'll go back to say this is direct-to-threat type issue. You've got shots fired in a building. You have to assume you're dealing with an active shooter event. You have to pursue that threat and stop it before more lives are lost.
I want to drill down a little bit more into that, Mo, because is an SRO, is a school resource officer expected to take down a shooter, expected to essentially give their lives in an effort to remove the threat?
I'm going to say absolutely. And if they're not willing to do that, they don't deserve to be in that position. This is a situation where, again, we're looking for when I say we, I'm talking about law enforcement agencies all around, should be looking for the absolute right person for that job. So that this selection process is critically important in terms of assigning the right officer to that position. It's the most unique position in law enforcement. There's nothing else like it. It's the most high-profile position in law enforcement. For good or for bad, you better make sure you're putting the right officer in that position. And then you better make sure they are specifically trained.
Now, Mo, there's another added element here. We talked about you're not training officers in the state of Florida. Specific to the state of Florida, there's now an effort to arm teachers. I'm curious if you see that as a positive or something that could actually have a negative impact on the work that SROs are supposed to do.
We've been very outspoken in terms of our belief that the most appropriate person to be armed in a school environment is a carefully selected, specifically trained officer, an SRO. We believe those are the folks that should be armed and prepared to protect the school. I hate to see this situation pushed onto educators. They've already got enough on their plate, and I hate to see them in a situation where they've got to be armed on top of that and possibly have to take the life of a student who in many cases is the shooter. I think that'd be pretty difficult.
I want to go back to a point that Chris made earlier, and this is about more broadly looking at the role of school resource officers and their presence in schools. We know that the presence is increasing, but we, along with that, we also have seen over the course of the past few years, in particular, video evidence and statistical evidence that students of color tend to be the targets of school discipline more aggressively. And so I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about the role that SROs have in schools and why we see those disparities, Chris.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's really a difficult balance with not just for an SRO in a school, but for the policy of how do you keep schools safe, but then how do you balance security, safety measures, and education? Not surprisingly, over the last 15 years, as school resource officers have a larger presence on campus, we've seen the arrest of students on campus rise by about 500%. That's not surprising because prior to that, there were no officers on campus or very few. That may or may not be a problem in and of itself, but it did lead to sort of that phrase that's commonly called the school to prison pipeline, where school incidents led to a more speedy entry into the juvenile justice system. The unintended problem, and explanations for this are still not clear, is that disproportionately, the arrest and the referrals to the juvenile justice system have been very disparate for minority youth. So depending on the school district makeup, it would be Black or Latino, Hispanic or Native American youth who are disproportionately referred from schools and arrested for various incidents from violent acts, but also all the way to just misbehaving and some other low-level offenses.
Mo, how much does racial bias awareness and training factor into the training that you do with the officers you work with?
I really appreciate you asking that. This is something that's very near and dear to our heart as well, something we're very focused on. We don't want to see students of any race or culture unnecessarily pushed into the juvenile justice system. We, in our basic SRO course a few years ago, we added a pretty significant block around cultural issues and especially implicit bias. We've also added a great deal of information in terms of helping SROs understand better how to de-escalate issues. We have a significant block on special education and understanding special needs students. Also added into that is a pretty significant piece on understanding adolescent brain development. And those types of pieces in our basic training, it usually surprises people that we've got that in law enforcement training. I think it needs to be in all law enforcement training. But I think that's had a significant impact on the folks who are part of our association. There's also a play on this into the issue of discipline, of student discipline. SROs shouldn't be there to mete out formal discipline. That belongs to the school district, and we're very clear on that in our training. And if I could add one more thing, this issue came up in 2013. I was testifying before a U.S. congressional committee, and one of the congressional leaders asked me, was our association making a push for more officers in schools? And my answer was, I believe every school in this country could benefit from a carefully selected, specifically trained SRO. But what we're more concerned about is officers working in schools who don't belong there and who are not properly trained. That's always going to be a concern of ours and one that we're always going to want to address.
Mo Kennedy is Executive Director for the National Association of School Resource Officers, and he himself spent 12 and a half years as a school resource officer in Hoover, Alabama. And Christopher Mallett is Professor of Social Work at Cleveland State University. Thanks to you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's Dale from St. Louis, Missouri. I see no reason why there should not be police in every school in today's climate. My son got along fine with the resource officer. He was always there to talk to somebody if need be. And I think it's absolutely necessary. It's not an option. It's a necessity nowadays.
My name's Carl Findling. I live in Bend, Oregon. I first was skeptical of putting police officers in school. Turned to be exactly the opposite. The interactions are fabulous in our community and has had very positive outcomes.
This is Henry calling from Buffalo, New York. I'm an African-American male with three sons, and I sent them to private school, that being one of the reasons why. They do not be harassed by police or questioned by police, particularly for something minor as stealing a pencil or talking back to a teacher.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you give here this afternoon will be the truth and nothing but the truth?
Yes, I swear.
Thank you. Have a seat.
What you're listening to there is the asylum hearing of Estrella Perez Mendoza, a transgender woman from El Salvador. Speaking through a court translator, she tells the judge that she left her home country because she was afraid for her safety.
Me dijeron que podría en el camino ser secuestrada.
They told me I could be kidnapped during this trip.
Violada.
Raped.
O obligada nuevamente a prostituirme.
Or forced into prostitution again.
The judge in that case said there was enough evidence to grant Mendoza asylum. But others like her aren't as lucky. Last weekend, Joanna Medina Leon, another trans woman, died in an El Paso hospital from HIV complications shortly after being released from ICE custody. She had complained of chest pains for weeks, a friend said in a statement, but was denied medical attention. Navigating the asylum system is challenging for many, but for a transgender woman, it can sometimes be life-threatening. Alice Driver is a freelance journalist based in Mexico City, and that recording from the courtroom comes from her work for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. I asked Alice what stuck out to her about the story of Joanna Medina León's death.
One thing I really want to point out in terms of the way that her death has been treated is that when ICE officials talked about her death, they, first of all, they called Medina illegal and an alien, which is part of a long-term plan of this administration to criminalize legal asylum seekers, because Medina was an asylum seeker and she passed a credible fear interview and she was waiting for her asylum case. And so this is something that's really worrying, and that we've seen these terms like illegal and alien used in other cases where people are actually asylum seekers, which is an international right. And so that's something that's really worrying about her case.
Alice, you've spent a long time with other trans women from El Salvador as they go through their asylum proceedings. Tell us what that experience is like.
So since July of 2017, I've followed two trans women from El Salvador through the entire asylum process. One of those trans women is received asylum and lives in San Diego. Her name is Michelle. And the other trans woman, who also lives openly with HIV, received asylum in Switzerland. So I have seen the way that Switzerland treats asylum seekers versus the way that U.S. treats asylum seekers, and there's a big difference.
And tell us a little bit about that difference.
So Carla Avalar, who is a human rights activist from El Salvador, who is well known for her human rights work, due to death threats, ended up seeking asylum in Switzerland. And because she's well known, she had support to get asylum in Switzerland. But I went to see her last October as part of a story that I'm working on. And she, first of all, she and her mother were seeking asylum in Switzerland. They were provided housing. So unlike asylum seekers in the U.S., they weren't sent to detention. They also, both of them were provided with medical treatment. So Carla has told me that the medical treatment in Switzerland has been absolutely amazing, that not only have they been, respectful and kind, but they've also treated issues specifically related to the trans community. And that's something that trans asylum seekers in the U.S. clearly aren't seeing at all.
Alice, what is the difference in how the asylum process is for trans women versus cisgender women?
Michelle, the trans woman who I followed through the asylum process in the United States, after she crossed the border to request asylum, which is her legal right, she was immediately sent to an all-male detention center, which is one of the immediate main problems with how ICE is treating specifically trans women. And one of the things that Michelle experienced that also was present in the case of Joanna Medina was that Border Patrol agents told Joanna Medina, for example, that she was not trans, and they told her that she was a man. So in this system, you have agents who are telling trans women, they're misgendering them, they're telling them, you know, you're a man, and there's a lot of discriminatory language and practices. But the more worrying thing is that, for example, when I talked to Michelle in detention, she told me, I know I'm at a greater risk for violence and sexual assault. And she was there for 7 months.
And I'm wondering, when some of your interview subjects were placed in detention with men, how did they cope?
Well, so Michelle, when I talked to her on the phone, first of all, it's very difficult to tell these stories because I was following Michelle. By the time she arrived in detention, it took me a long time to identify where she was. And also I had to write her a letter because in order to communicate with her in detention, that was the only way that I was allowed to communicate with her. I wrote her a letter, included my phone number, and then she called me because I put money on, we all know, calls out of detention are extremely expensive. I put money on her detention phone call system. So she called me and she actually broke down crying when we were talking on the phone. And she said that she had experienced violence. And she said, I don't want to talk about it because I don't want to be re-traumatized. And that's something that I respect. You know, as a reporter, I know that it's very likely that she was assaulted or potentially raped. But if she doesn't want to talk about that, I'm not going to make her open up that wound.
That's good reporting practice generally. Are there any positive stories about where these women ultimately ended up?
Well, in the case of Michelle, she does have a positive story because after 7 months in a male detention center, she did go to her asylum hearing, and she had a female judge who was, the asylum hearing was incredibly emotional, and the judge listened to her story. And in the case of most trans women, they have experienced incredible violence, and they do have documentation, whether that be hospital records or police records. And so in the case of Michelle, she did have a lot of documentation, and the judge said, I can see that you have a credible reason to request asylum, and that if you do get sent back to El Salvador, you will likely die, and therefore I grant you asylum. And so her case was very moving and just a reminder of the reasons why asylum exists. And she's now living in San Diego. She's studying English at a community college, and she works at a pizza restaurant. And I just talked to her the other day on Facebook, and for me, her story is just, that's the kind of person that I want to be living, to be living and working in the United States in a productive and loving and thoughtful citizen.
Alice Driver is an immigration reporter based in Mexico City, and she followed the journeys of a number of trans women through the U.S. asylum system. Alice, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Being in love with a statue, a sexy, handsome, chiseled statue of a Korean Eric from The Little Mermaid. It's just too perfect, you know? Like, I never felt like I could be myself around him. So yeah, I'm gonna die all alone in a big house all by myself in complete, utter, and deafening silence. I can feel it, Marcus.
There, there.
There, there? That's all you got?
Well, I had more at the beginning of your speech, and then I forgot it by the end.
That clip you just heard comes from Always Be My Maybe, a new movie released by Netflix last week starring Ali Wong and Randall Park. And it's a typical rom-com in many ways, the story of childhood friends falling in and out of love. But the film focuses on an Asian-American love story that moves far beyond stereotypes to create funny, fleshed-out characters. And that is notable, as mainstream comedy has historically kept Asian and Asian-American characters at the margins. Caroline Keung Ah Hong is an associate professor of English at Queens College CUNY, and she's currently working on a book about Asian American comedy. Caroline, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, Tanzina. Thank you so much for having me.
So Always Be My Maybe, I will say, full disclosure, I thought it was fantastic. Mm-hmm. Why do you think it's resonating with audience and particularly Asian American viewers?
You know, I think folks are just hungry for things that are fun and pleasurable, enjoyable, that feature folks that look like us. And it's not a big deal, but there are experiences and stories and details that are just really specific and grounded in our experiences as Asian Americans. And that is, you know, unfortunately, still kind of remarkable.
And one of the things, we sort of talked about Crazy Rich Asians, and that was mm-hmm. a big blockbuster, and now we have Always Be My Maybe. But what struck out to me was that Always Be My Maybe is really about the Asian American experience.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a really long history of a kind of complicated relationship that Asian Americans have had in comedy and humor, as you suggest. And this is, I think, just a more recent example of how Asian Americans are kind of negotiating that on their own terms. And that's really exciting to see.
We mentioned Ali Wong, and we heard a clip at the top of Always Be My Maybe, and she stars in the film, and she also co-wrote the film.
Right.
Ali Wong has done tons of stand-up comedy. She's done it while notably pregnant.
People praise my husband for coming to all of my doctor's appointments with me. Oh my God, I can't believe he comes to all your doctor's appointments. He is so supportive. Guess who else has to go to those doctor appointments? Me! I'm the star of the show. There's nothing for the camera to see if I'm not there. But he's the hero for playing Candy Crush while I get my blood drawn. Meanwhile, if I do mushrooms 7 months pregnant, I'm a bad mommy.
Tell us a little bit about how she subverts certain stereotypes in her work.
Yeah, I think she's been really smart in her comedy. You know, she's sort of raunchy. She talks a lot about sex. She talks a lot about things that maybe fly in the face of racial and gender expectations people have for Asian American women. And so I think a lot of folks find her comedy really refreshing for that, because she's kind of bucking those stereotypes, going against those expectations. And she's doing in a way that does feel kind of fresh and free.
And I'm wondering if you could dig a little more into that. Like, what are some of the stereotypes that she's trying to subvert here? Because we know that in the 1980s, a lot of the films that I grew up watching
right.
had Asian actors as side characters, but a lot of these roles were really, really offensive. And I'm thinking of things like Indiana Jones and on and on. Could you tell us a little bit more about the stereotyping of Asians and Asian American roles up to this point?
Absolutely. And, you know, I would say this history stretches, you know, at least as far back as the 19th century, way before even the 1980s. But those stereotypes that we see, you know, even today, have these roots in this kind of long immigration history and the way that immigration has been excluded, restricted, et cetera. And so, you know, the primary stereotypes about Asians in the U.S. is that, you know, that we're foreign, that we're alien, and that kind of perpetual foreigner stereotype works often in concert with this model minority stereotype, right? And so you do in the 80s see all these comic nerd characters in mainstream comedy. So as you mentioned, Short Round in Indiana Jones, Data in Goonies, of course, Long Duk Dong in 16 Candles, you have Apu on The Simpsons. So there's just a litany of these kinds of characters that are obviously there to be made fun of for being different, for being strange, and that has long, long roots in U.S. cultural history. And so part of what I find so exciting about a lot of Asian American comedy now is that it's not even really concerned about combating those stereotypes, right? Whereas I think a lot of late 20th century Asian American comedy was really intentional in thinking about what are those stereotypes and how can we sort of challenge and counter them. And a lot of the comedy we see now is actually people just being funny on their own terms, telling their really specific, grounded stories, a lot of stories that we haven't heard before in the mainstream. And that is really what's exciting. It's not being sort of pigeonholed or restricted or bounded by these earlier kinds of stereotypes.
I want to play some tape here from Filipino-American comedian Joe Coy from his 2017 Netflix special.
She never took us to the doctor. My mom never took us to the doctor. My mom raised us like we were still in the Philippines. She tried to cure everything at home, like a real Filipino woman. You had to die to go to the hospital.
Caroline, I'm thinking there's a lot of self-deprecating humor, absolutely. A lot of second generation pointing out first generation. I think even back in, when we think about Ali Wong, she talks a lot about intra-Asian American issues, right?
Absolutely.
And Hari Kondabolu, who talks a lot about colonialism. Like, what do these examples tell us about the evolution of Asian American narratives in American comedy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, what I've already suggested, which is that there's such a broader spectrum of what can be sort of covered and engaged under the umbrella of Asian American comedy. And not all of it is perfect or unproblematic, but that just the sheer fact that we have this range so that we can have sort of anti-imperialist critiques. We can have someone like Aparna Nancherla talking about mental health and depression and anxiety. We can have folks doing all different kinds of work under the umbrella of Asian American comedy, and that we're not sort of stuck in this kind of oppositional role of just saying like, well, this is the stereotype and I'm not like that and let me show that. Even things like, you know, Joe Coy's been around for a long time, and I think he actually has a new special coming out this summer, maybe later this month. And a lot of younger kind of up and coming Asian American comedians, you know, they're not even really talking about that intergenerational stuff that is so overdetermined in Asian American and immigrant stories, that a lot of them are talking about other kinds of experiences.
And sort of talking about moving past comedy that's really based in bucking stereotypes and bucking the trend, mm-hmm. where do you see work that still needs to be done in terms of advancing Asian American representation in comedy?
It really depends on what sector of pop culture we're talking about. But I do think in terms of representation, a lot of mainstream Asian American comedy is still dominated by straight men and East Asians. And I would love to see more that centers the experiences of Southeast Asians, South Asians, women, queer folks, disabled folks, etc. But for me, I'm actually not really picky. Part of what I'm looking for is just more narrative plenitude, as Viet Nguyen says. You know, the more Asian American comedy we have, the lower the stakes, the less pressure there is on any one thing or person to kind of be everything or to be perfect. So, you know, I think that for me is really the goal. I don't love seeing folks who pit kind of Asian American comedy or comedians against each other, which one's better, ranking them. Part of what I'm looking for is to just see more across the board in every cultural arena, in every form, every medium.
Caroline Kyung Ah-Hong is an associate professor of English at Queens College at CUNY, and she's currently working on a book about Asian American comedy. Caroline, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. It's been great broadcasting out of KUER studios here in Salt Lake City. We're headed back to New York after this, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.